You're listening to 340B Unscripted.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. I'm Greg Wilson here with my co-host, Rob Nahupi. Hoopy, what's going on, man?
Not much, Greg. Just got back from a pharmacy conference and paying attention to kind of all things 340B. Had some great 340B discussions, and I'm kind of excited to get through some updated news and then get to our main topic today. It's going to be a fun one.
Yeah. A few things happening in the 340B space. Our main topic of discussion today is around, I think, a hot topic for 340B providers, pharmacotherapy services, and how, you know, leveraging clinical pharmacy expertise at your organization might help your 340B program. So we've got Matt Parker from our team that's going to join us on the other side of a break coming up here. But let's catch up on some stuff in the news. I think the biggest news story since we last talked, Rob, was HRSA publishing the final rule for the administrative dispute resolution process. This thing is a long time in coming, right?
It feels like it's been almost a decade, but yes, I don't know the exact date, but it feels like a very long time. And there's always some information came out and then pushback, and yeah, so exciting that this is finally here. I mean, I think that was one thing that the legislatures had, you know, really told HRSA is that, hey, you've got rulemaking authority in three specific areas. Why don't you use that first before we grant any more rulemaking authority? And I think HRSA's been really trying hard. I know it's probably a lot of hoops for them to jump through and to get everything done. And you know, how do you make everyone happy? It's one of those, you know, by the time you get done, if both sides are slightly unhappy but can live with it, then you probably got to the right place.
Yeah. I think we don't understand the full mechanics of the process yet. HRSA is going to have to publish what the clerical steps are for submitting a claim through the ADR process. The rule was published in the Federal Register on April 19th, and they've got 60 days before they can implement it. So we should expect some clarification from HRSA in the near future ahead of the June 19th implementation date of the ADR final rule. So I'm sure, Rob, we'll be talking about this in more detail once we have a better understanding of what the HRSA process is going to look like.
Right. I mean, the one thing we know that people should be aware of is that there is a 3-year look back. And so it's that 3-year clock is ticking. And so as soon as we understand exactly, you know, what and how you do the submissions, then, you know, there's definitely something people want to get on if they have things that they do want to submit for. I know a hot topic is, what do we do about the manufacturer restrictions? Is that something we want to submit to through the ADR process? You know, not knowing whether that would, depends on the courts, how that all plays out. But that is something people might want to submit. And of course, you know, that started more than 3 years ago. And so you're already losing some time on some of the manufacturer restrictions that occurred early in the process.
And I'll be kind of paying attention to what other legal experts out there say about this, because one of the provisions in the ADR rule is that you submit your claim through the ADR process after good faith efforts have stalled out. So what you know is a material effort, I guess, on a covered entity's behalf to try to address these contract pharmacy restrictions, if that's something that you're going to submit a claim for, is, you know, participating in 340B ESP pharmacy designations and claim uploads. Is that satisfactory in the eyes of HRSA as a covered entity's kind of good faith effort to try to address the contract pharmacy restrictions? And then can they begin with the ADR process without having to reach out to individual manufacturers? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the limiting steps are for covered entities to pursue a potential claim against manufacturers related to the contract pharmacy restrictions. We just don't know yet.
Yeah, definitely a good point, because I mean, because it's just kind of fact, right? It's just put out there, the ESP program and all the restrictions. There wasn't really much to push back against, because at the time, the manufacturers just told the cover and easy, this is how it is. There wasn't really a lot of good faith discussions about it.
Yeah. So, stay tuned for that. If you've got questions, or if you have ideas or thoughts around that, or if you're a covered entity that's kind of, you know, trying to wrap your heads around how you're going to manage this moving forward, we'd love to hear what people are concerned about, or what people's thought processes are around moving forward with an ADR claim. So reach out to us. Let us know if you've got some questions or you want to talk about it. Moving down through the news, again, got more and more traction around state level legislation protecting contract pharmacy provisions. Kansas, they did successfully pass contract pharmacy law, but the that law has been suspended. They're going to be sending that back to the governor's office. Rob, tell us a little bit about what you take away from what's happening in Kansas.
Yeah, interesting, right? This was some legislation that passed, and then the lawmakers or legislature voted to do a long-term pause of their law, and that was after the governor signed her state budget. And what's fascinating about the way they did it on this long-term pause, they said, well, let's pause until the Supreme Court weighs in on it. Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court hasn't said they are going to weigh in on it. So it's like, we're going to pause until something that may never happen occurs.
Yeah.
Which I find fascinating. Right. So I'm not sure what to think about this one. Now there isn't, you know, there's some people saying that there's still a chance, right? The governor could line item veto this out. And then, of course, if the governor line item vetoes it out, then it would require the Congress to come back. I think through some kind of a majority rule, go against that or the veto. So there is a path forward still for Kansas, but, I guess we'll have to wait and see if the governor decides the line item veto or not, and then see what Congress does after that. So a couple things still have to occur for that for the Kansas contract pharmacy manufacturer restriction law to go into place.
Another thing that we talked about before that we're tracking closely is a lawsuit between Baptist Health of Alabama and Humana to try to allow the hospital to recoup underpayments from Humana's Medicare Advantage plan. So again, we've got the CMS Medicare Part B remedy that's already been implemented and initiated at the beginning of this year, but still don't understand how covered entities might be able to receive repayment for lost revenue due to Medicare Advantage adopting similar price cuts. The insurance company, so Humana, had motioned to dismiss the lawsuit, but the judge ruled against the dismissal motion, and they sent the said, look, the hospital providers are allowed to amend their complaint. So this is a case that's going to continue, right?
It is. Yeah. So Humana submitted multiple documents on this, getting this case dismissed, and that hasn't occurred. And what's fascinating, I think one of the arguments they're making was about something about fictitious parties. And I won't pretend to be a lawyer and understand exactly what's going on there. But so instead, for one of the, you know, dismissal reasons, the judge is actually allowing Baptist to amend their filing to address this fictitious party component. It's almost like, okay, not only are we not dismissing it, we're going to let the covered entity actually correct one of the issues that you have. The other ones, I guess, maybe weren't sufficient enough to cause a dismissal. So all we know is this is continuing. So all eyes on, right, if Humana is going to be forced to pay back some of the savings, and wow, it just feels like the dams are going to burst open at that point. So that one's definitely a watcher.
Great. Anything else in the news? Any tidbits you picked up from Assembia?
No, Assembly was fun, right? For everyone, that's the conference I was at this past week. It's a specialty pharmacy conference, a little different. Actually lots of manufacturers there, some other vendors are there. I met with quite a few covered entities that happened to be there, so that was really nice. Yeah. Catching with some of those staff in the pharmacy or in leadership. But nothing major from Assembia other than, I mean, you know, biosimilars are going to be a big deal. Us watching that's going to be big. Reimbursement is a huge hot topic about getting these things reimbursed. And so, but really at the end of the day, it's, a lot of the focus and goal, especially at a conference like that, is how do we get people out of the hospital? How do we get them to be treated at home and infusion centers at a lower cost? And there's more and more, you know, drugs coming on the market as well as the biosimilars to make it lower cost and lower the overall cost of healthcare. So I think a lot of positive momentum there, but you know, it's always that thing, right? Hospitals are always trying to figure out almost how they put themselves out of business by not having patients stay in the hospital, because that's better for healthcare.
Interesting. All right. Let's take a quick break. On the other side, we will talk with Matt Parker and discuss the value of pursuing pharmacotherapy services.
Yeah, that sounds good. And I forgot, can I add one more or two more things?
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah.
One thing is, this is something that came up, you know, last year, and we've never talked about it, but I don't know if people know, in rural areas, rural hospitals can actually, file with a CMS to become a rural emergency hospital, so an REH, a different designation. Of course, that REH designation isn't one that qualifies for 340B. And so if you're a critical access hospital or a small rural that's maybe a sole community and you switch because you're going to get better reimbursement, right? CMS is trying to figure out better reimbursement for these rural hospitals so they don't close down. Well, the problem's been if you do that, then you lose your 340B status. And so you'd almost have to look at it and say, okay, is it worth getting slightly better reimbursement, but I'm going to lose my 340B savings? And maybe with the manufacturer restrictions getting larger and larger, maybe that impacted enough, this became true. So up to this point, very few hospitals actually signed up for this new designation, I think 23, according to the 340B report. So what's interesting, there is some legislation now at a federal level from the House. So a bipartisan, one Republican, one Democrat, who's putting out legislation to try and get this new designation included. So these types of hospitals, 50 beds or less, rural area, meet all the designation requirements. You can then get the better reimbursement and still keep your 340B savings intact. So just wanted to put it out there that there's a possibility. They identify, you know, in this process, nearly 700 hospitals at risk for closing, and that this REH designation could help. And if you can leave that in combination with 340B, we might be able to keep some of these hospitals' doors open, right? That's my biggest fear, and why sometimes I got into this business and consulting to actually help critical access hospitals is my initial plan, because you think about these rural hospitals closing, that's a significant impact to the populations in those areas. So kind of excited to see where this goes. It feels like this is one that people shouldn't have a problem with. I'm sure, you know, people who are affected negatively by 340B might not be excited about more hospitals qualifying, but it's really the same hospitals qualifying. It doesn't change the qualification. It just means that, hey, you can get this designation, better reimbursement, but at the same time, keep 340B. So I'm going to follow that one, but that one's important only because we've got a lot of people listening out there that fall in this category in these rural hospitals, and something we want to watch, because then it might make sense to go for this REH designation as long as you can maintain 340B. And then the final thing, Greg, I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday, buddy.
No. How did you know? That's supposed to be
little birdie told me.
Thank
you. Happy birthday, Greg. So for those out there, we're actually recording on Greg's birthday today. You got any good plans for today?
Yeah, I think we're going to do Taco Tuesday on a Thursday. We're recording on Thursday here. So we're going to have tacos for night, for dinner tonight. Nice. So maybe a margarita. I don't know. We'll see.
Taco Tuesday on a Thursday?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I like it. I like it.
Yeah. Cool. Me and Dwayne The Rock Johnson celebrate May 2nd, I guess. So,
wow.
My birthday brother. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll talk with Matt and dig into pharmacotherapy stuff in a few minutes.
Happy birthday, Greg. This is Chelsea. You are seriously one of my favorite people to work with. I just appreciate so many things about you. You're patient, you're kind, you're understanding, easygoing, fun. So many other things. You're just basically pretty amazing. So thank you so much for choosing to come work with Spendman Pharmacy. You're just fun to talk to. You're extremely genuine. I've always appreciated how thoughtful you are and what you say and how you respond to all of us that you work with. You truly are a leader in every sense of the word. So thank you so much for being you. And thank you so much for being born. I am very blessed to just know you. And I know the rest of our team is too. Happy birthday, friend.
Greg, happy birthday to the only podfather I know. You rock. I hope you have a fantastic day, Jake.
Happy birthday to my podcast celeb friend. Hope your day is filled with all the things you love.
Greg, this is Jasmine. Just wanted to say happy birthday. You're so much fun to work with, and we couldn't have asked for a better podfather. Hope you have a good one.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Rob, welcome back. Matt Parker, thanks for joining the podcast again.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about pharmacotherapy service. So I feel like this is a hot topic in the provider space right now, not just related to 340B, but also related to health systems and hospitals and clinics trying to better manage some of these high-cost specialty drugs. Lots of, you know, most of the newer agents that are approved by the FDA and are being marketed for chronic disease state management, they're complicated medications and require a good bit of clinical oversight. And who better than to manage these products than pharmacists? So, you know, the value of pharmacotherapy services offered by your organization, I think, really is an appealing strategy for, one, managing outcomes in your patient populations, but there's also going to be a 340B component to it when we get into the nuts and bolts of the discussion here. first, let's kind of clarify terminology, because I'm talking with clients or other hospitals and clinics around their interest in pursuing a service like this. There's different terms that are thrown out there for pharmacist-driven clinical services in the pharmacotherapy space. We typically refer to it as pharmacotherapy clinic services. Some folks will refer to it as disease state management. There's the term medication therapy management, or MTMs, really driven by Medicare. Matt or Rob, either one of you want to start with kind of defining the terminology that we're going to use throughout this conversation to reference what we see as pharmacotherapy services?
Sure, I can jump in here, and because this is kind of one of my pet peeves, is the terminology, and it is very confusing. These terms get kind of used interchangeably, but we'll start with the first. So pharmacotherapy services or pharmacotherapy clinic, you'll hear me refer to it probably throughout our time today as PTC, just because everyone loves a three-letter acronym. That is your quintessential pharmacotherapy clinic, where we have a physician referring to a pharmacist for the management of a specific drug therapy. And most of the time, that's going to be fairly limited in terms of that referral. So it's particularly just maybe one drug, or maybe it's one specific group of drugs. So maybe it's insulin therapy management. And inside that arrangement, that pharmacist is able to manage the patient's various insulin types. Then there's also disease state management, which is I would say, kind of an acronym, if you will, or the same a name there, and that's more focused in on a specific disease state, right? So a lot of times it's more specialized and also looking at a broader amount of care. So I think about a heart failure clinic, or maybe a diabetes clinic, or maybe even a metabolic disease clinic, where you're looking at multiple factors and multiple types of medications, and also ancillary medications that you're managing. And then the last is MTM, or medication therapy management. This is the one that, you know, a lot of folks come to me and they say, hey, I'd like to start an MTM clinic. And I always have to kind of begin to unpack that. I try to stay away from the term MTM just because that is a official program as part of the Medicare Part D program. And so MTM is a service by which you can do medication optimization, largely looking at like polypharmacy, making some recommendations, and there's the ability to bill Medicare Part D for that services. I want to be clear though, you know, we're always talking about 340B on this podcast, and MTM services typically don't qualify for the 340B aspect. So I put that to the side and really stick with PTC, pharmacotherapy, or, you know, more of a comprehensive disease state management clinic.
Rob, any other pearls you want to share with regard to terminology or some of the semantics around this?
Biggest one for me is I agree with Matt on that for MTM, you know, because that was something reimbursed through retail pharmacies, and I don't like using MTM as much, even though I like what it stands for, medication therapy management. I do like pharmacotherapy service, because I really think at the end of the day, that's kind of, you know, it's really what we're doing. We're expanding what our from a clinical level, what our pharmacists are doing, and really focusing on the drug therapy or pharmacotherapy. And that extra level of service, being able to provide more, you know, more efficient or more optimal pharmacy care. So I like that term personally, but I think Matt very, very well stated the difference between the three.
All right. Well, let's talk about the benefits of pharmacist-driven pharmacotherapy service. You know, I primarily think of the value of this related to clinical benefits, so improved health outcomes. But I'm sure a lot of folks that are, you know, talking about pharmacotherapy service now are really trying to leverage their 340B program eligibility. I think there's lots of data out there that have documented how pharmacists can generate, you know, health outcomes improvements, you know, lots of data. And I think one of the high profile examples of data is a Surgeon General report back in 2011 that outlined some fairly significant and compelling arguments for having pharmacists involved in improving health outcomes in complicated patient populations. We've got the Asheville Project that have that's tied a pharmacoeconomic benefit to pharmacists being involved in these types of activities. Matt, from your perspective, when, you know, if you're sitting in a pharmacy director role or a leadership role, how do you sell the value of pharmacotherapy services? What do you think people should be communicating to their leadership groups and their executive members around why it might be beneficial to pursue this type of service offering?
Great question, Greg. And I'll say that a lot of times what I see when I start meeting with pharmacy leaders, they're acutely focused and on the financial benefit of a PTC program. And I always try to go in and say, okay, let's round out our presentation, particularly as we're going to executive leadership. We've got to present this potentially to, you know, physician chairs. And so we don't want to go and say, hey, this is just a great way for us to expand the 340B program and to save a lot of money for the organization. We want to make sure that we're given that round, well-rounded picture of what PTC or pharmacotherapy can be and what it can mean for our patients. And that's exactly what you're alluding to here, Greg, is those clinical benefits. I always like to say, let's lead first with the clinical and quality aspects of a pharmacotherapy clinic, that by putting a pharmacist in the care, we know from primary literature, as you've cited, that there is benefit to the patient. And there's better outcomes when a pharmacist is involved in the care, because we can take that additional time that oftentimes the primary care physician or even a specialist doesn't have time to take inside the office to really, you know, dig in deep to what's going on with this patient's insulin, or to dig in deep what's going on with this patient's uncontrolled hypertension, and, you know, really try to figure out, is it diet related? Is it medication adherence related? What's going on? So the PTC allows for that additional time to really dig in and understand what the underlying cause is, and then hopefully correct that. And so, again, I like to say it's two sides of a coin. We want to have a quality and a clinical play, but we also have that financial benefit, yes, that we get from the 340B program. So in most cases, I say, let's lead again with that that clinical effectiveness and the outcomes. And then it's a windfall that we also receive this benefit from the 340B program. But in doing so, we're improving the care and the lives of the patients that we're serving. And with that, it's not just maybe jumping ahead just a little bit, but just also be mindful of, right, employee populations. A lot of organizations are self-insured. And so you got a lot of employees that are part of your insurance program, and, you know, using your pharmacotherapy services to really target some of those high cost beneficiaries can greatly improve the health of your fellow coworkers, but also can bring additional savings to the bottom line of your health plan.
Yeah. So, you know, Rob, you know, I thought Matt did a great job kind of summarizing the primary objective of pursuing this is related to the health outcomes that we're going to likely yield from pharmacists managing these patients' complex medical conditions. But there's also going to be a financial benefit by leveraging 340B program eligibility. So maybe share just some high-level insights around how a pharmacotherapy service might want to be set up to take advantage of a covered entity's participation in the 340B program so that you can extend access to those 340B priced drugs to these patients.
Yeah, I mean, so I just got to agree with Matt on this one, right? I always tell people I wouldn't necessarily do anything just because of 340B. You know, where can we find a win-win? And I think this is an amazing area, because we're always looking at trying to expand what we do as pharmacists. So, I mean, for years, ever since I was in pharmacy school 20 years ago, we've always been looking at how do we expand, you know, what our pharmacists can do, all this training we have to provide more clinical benefit to patients and, you know, save costs, be more efficient, better outcomes, all those things. So I love that that should be the first driver of what we're doing. The hard part is we still don't get well reimbursed in the pharmacy side to provide those services, right? So how do you cover some of that cost? And that's the beautiful part about using a pharmacotherapy clinic within a 340B covered entity in a provider-based area. So providing you do it under the hospital covered entity qualified location where you set up the PTC clinic, then the prescriptions that pharmacist is actually consulting on become eligible. Now, I won't get into expanded patient 340B patient definition, all those things. There could be a larger opportunity there just depending on where you sit on that while we wait to see how HRSA responds to some of that. But just simply by the pharmacist providing clinical care in a qualified location, that condition and those drugs that are being reviewed then become 340B eligible. And so that savings from those prescriptions then can help offset some of the costs for your pharmacist actually providing the service and the benefit to the patients. And true, in some cases, that could actually increase your savings to a certain degree. Now, it gets complicated because a lot of insurance does go through, a lot of these drugs might go through specialty pharmacy, or the patients might not be filling the prescriptions at their own in-house retail, even if they have one. So now you're getting into, okay, but now that's a contract pharmacy, and do I even have access to those drugs? So even in some cases, you might do the service and you might not have financial benefit. So where you can have financial benefit, you do need to probably look at that so you can offset some of this cost. And then of course, then some patients might be Medicaid. So you're already passing on the cost for some of those, depending on which Medicaid they have and which state you're in. Medicare is going to have MFM here in the future as part of the IRA. Sorry for all the acronyms. Matt talked about the three-letter acronyms before. We do love them for some reason. So that's where I'm at on this, that there's some savings there to help offset this cost so we can get that clinical benefit for patients.
All right. I'm going to come back to you, Rob, in a little bit and talk a little bit about the regulatory challenges. Because, I mean, I'm glad you brought up expanded patient definition. That's not really what we're talking about. And even though pharmacotherapy service is kind of a hot topic today, it's not because of the Genesis case or because of an interest in kind of being a little more liberal or progressive in how we define patient eligibility. This is a longstanding strategy that many organizations have used prior to the Genesis case, prior to the contract pharmacy restrictions, and prior to even HRSA's kind of altered enforcement efforts circa 2019, when we saw a decrease in their attention to diversion, right? This is not something that's been newly pursued by covered entities. This is a very longstanding, well-documented, well-tested strategy in terms of 340B program compliance, right?
Right. It predates the whole Genesis law case and all of this. This is just something that covered entities have been doing. Yeah. And a lot of times for their own employee group is a great place to start. You can kind of control that. You can encourage your employees to be seen. And then again, a lot of times you're focusing on those more complex disease states that just need more support. Right. I think our providers out there are doing the best they can, but they're seeing as many patients as they can, helping as many patients as they can. Yeah. So you get these complex disease states to have that pharmacist intervening on a more frequent basis with the patient, making sure that, you know, they're monitoring for side effects, making sure dosing's optimal, that they're actually taking the medication, all these things that are critical for success in that therapy, pharmacists can do through a PTC clinic. So yeah. I think it's an amazing service if you have the ability to add one.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the operational challenges or just the scale of putting something like this together. Matt, I know you've helped some covered entities stand this up. This is not a small task. There are many steps, and it's a fairly complex service to kick off. Let's discuss some of the different operational models. And you have the tough task here, I think, to try to, in a short amount of time, kind of explain what the conventional workflow of these types of services looks like.
Yeah, certainly. And you're right, Greg, tons of steps and tons of really due diligence that's needed to start. I think, Rob, you kind of referenced that not all places are a good fit for PTC, maybe not all disease states or even all drugs makes sense to do PTC. And so I'd like to say, first and foremost, before you even start down the path of doing a PTC, you really need to assess your data and understand what the opportunity is and where it makes sense within your organization. You may find that it comes down to really just a few non-eligible clinics that you're really going to try to target, or there's a few disease states or even just a few high-cost medications where it really makes sense for you to focus your efforts on. And having that information upfront helps you to kind of structure and build your program out appropriately. Just thinking that you're going to have this wide open door and you're going to accept all of these different types of patients or types of disease states, probably not the most successful way of doing that. But going into kind of the operational model, and I'm going to speak to it very quickly, just the most simplest form, there's several steps to a PTC that we see occurring. So a physician, and since we're talking 340B, this is going to be a non-eligible 340B location. So this is a physician practice that maybe is associated with your health system that you've established a collaborative practice agreement with in order to provide care on behalf of that physician, is going to refer a patient to you, and they're going to refer that patient to you for specific services. And again, it's going to be management of a specific drug or group of drugs, or again, a specific disease state, just depending on how that's defined in that collaborative practice. And so that patient's now going to come to the pharmacist, and they're going to come to the pharmacist for that care. That's going to be their primary point for that. And so the pharmacist is going to do a complete workup. They're going to review the chart. They're going to do a clinical assessment, see if there's any additional labs that need to be ordered, or see if there's anything from the patient's history that would, lead them to believe that medication A versus medication B would be appropriate, one versus the other. And then once they've kind of done their review, there's an actual meet with a patient, and this can be done, we'll get into probably a little bit more detail, in person or through some type of virtual encounter, where we actually meet with the patient, go through kind of a clinical assessment, generate a note for that encounter that's happening, and then ultimately a prescription gets generated for the drug, ideally from that eligible location. And then if it's a new patient that's just starting brand new therapy, a lot of times folks like to follow up with that patient, maybe 2 weeks post-start, you know, just a quick phone call to them and say, hey, Ms. Jones, we started you on a GLP-1. I just want to know how that's going. Do you have any problem, any injection site reactions or anything we can help you with? And then ultimately that patient would be scheduled for a follow-up visit in the future. And that follow-up visit is going to be determined based off of disease state, the drug, the patient. You know, some patients may be good to just be seen once a year. Some patients are going to need to be seen more than one time per year because you're going to titrate them through a therapy, or maybe they just need more assistance with their medication. So that's the high level 30,000 foot view of what a PTC is. When I meet with folks, and I usually say, you know, kind of like a Baskin Robbins, there's probably 31 different flavors to doing this, you know, all slightly different variations, but mostly following that pathway of those kind of hallmarks for a PTC clinic.
In terms of organizational structure, any thoughts on whether it's beneficial to operate PTC out of kind of like a standalone pharmacy department based cost center, or is this a scenario or a service that we can embed pharmacists into maybe an existing primary care clinic or other ambulatory clinic of the hospital?
Yeah, fantastic question. And Rob, I want you to jump in here as well. So obviously our strategy has shifted slightly with the sunsetting of 4301 or QA 4301. And so a lot of our clients now are looking to start the PTC operations inside an existing eligible location so that they can start quicker. A lot of folks are starting in parallel, meaning they're starting in an existing location while at the same time trying to establish their own department that would then be ultimately registered on the cost report and then gain 340B eligibility in the future. But that timeline is just really critical now that we're having to wait, you know, depending on your cost cycle, it could be up to 18 to 22 months before you're able to get 340B eligibility in that site. And so most folks are trending toward at least starting in an existing site is what I'm seeing. And Rob, I think that's probably what you're seeing as well.
No, I agree. And you know, it's a lot easier or more efficient if you have an existing ambulatory site, like a primary care practice or an internal medicine site, where it makes a lot of sense for that PTC clinic to be part of. But you're right, the inability to say from a 340B qualification standpoint that a new location's eligible for 340B without waiting for it to be on a final cost report. And of course, if it's off-site, then registering it. Matt's right, we're talking well over a year, typically a year and a half before you can actually access 340B for that site. So that's a big delay, especially if you're trying to cover the costs. And right now, it's not the best time for health systems to be looking at new services that can't cover their own costs, because most health systems aren't you know, they're running in the red basically. So it's a tough sell. And so for us to be able to get more of these clinical services out for patients to improve care, we've got to be just strategic on how we do that so that it doesn't cause a negative financial impact to the organization. And I will say the other thing that we're fighting against, depending on the state you're in and depending on your payers, sometimes, believe it or not, 2024, we're still struggling in some cases, especially in some states, on getting pharmacist reimbursement. That's still a challenge. And if you think about a new location, the other reason sometimes it's really a good idea to combine it with another clinical location is because we don't get, if we're not getting reimbursement, then on the cost report itself, that new location may not have charges, right? So you're always trying to figure out, how do I get charges on here? Because the other rule that you need to register a new location or for a new location to be eligible when the cost report's filed is that you have both expenses and charges. So and there's strategic ways that you can still get charges on there. Even if you don't get reimbursed, you can still charge, but that's just extra work, and all these things have to be figured out, right? You have to have a plan, and that's probably the biggest thing there. But we're still seeing both ways for people to do it.
Yeah, so I'm you brought that up, Rob. I'm kind of jump to that now when we talk about 340B compliance considerations. So the clinic that's offering this pharmacotherapy service really needs to kind of meet that definition of an eligible 340B location. So that means those pharmacists and that service needs to be offered out of a reimbursable outpatient department if we're talking about a hospital, right? So a clinic with a cost center that hits lines 50 to 118 on the Medicare cost report with revenue and expense reported on worksheets A and C.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So not a department or a clinic that could be operated out of a 190 clinic, a below the line clinic, or even out of an inpatient or retail pharmacy cost center needs to be linked in some manner to an outpatient reimbursable department, which I think is a step in the process that maybe some covered entities have overlooked in the past.
Right. Matt probably has some examples, but right, when I've talked to people about it, they're like, oh yeah, we're doing that out of our retail pharmacy. I'm like, well, The retail pharmacy is not a qualified location. In fact, it's probably on the 190s on top of that, but it's still not a clinical location. It's a pharmacy. Yeah. And so you really have to think about, is there a pharmacy? So even if you're already doing MTM out of your retail pharmacy, that doesn't count. Mm-hmm. That doesn't qualify patients. It has to be done out of a qualified clinical location. And Greg, you're right, 50 to 118 with expenses and charges. And retail pharmacies I've never seen charges on the cost report because retail pharmacies don't bill as an inpatient or an OPPS location. So yeah, that's definitely an issue that good take-home message today that even whether it's your inpatient pharmacy or your outpatient pharmacy or even your infusion pharmacy, these technically aren't qualified locations. Not an infusion center is a qualified location. So I guess in theory, if you're practicing out of that would be feasible, but not the pharmacies themselves.
Yeah. You know, and another 340B compliance consideration, you know, policies is a big thing that HRSA will focus on during audits. You know, Matt, the process that you're describing here, again, as long as it's able to occur within the scope of pharmacist practice in the given state that they're in, you know, the pharmacist is writing the prescription. So the pharmacist essentially is going to be the eligible provider when we look at patient definition. So either of you, any thoughts around how you have to delineate that in your 340B policies to account for a non-physician kind of serving as the eligible provider to satisfy 340B eligibility determinations?
Yeah, it's definitely, you do have the pharmacist writing it sometime. And I guess I probably should clarify my quintessential example there. Many times it's the pharmacist writing it on behalf of the original referring physician as well. And so I like to say I'm old school. I mean, I started in pharmacy back when there was truly telephone orders and we wrote things down on paper. And so, you know, it would be the equivalent of someone picking up the telephone and saying, calling in a telephone order for Dr. Smith and giving that order. And so we see that happening quite a bit. But yes, there are instances where the pharmacist is the one actually writing that order and is the prescriber. And so making sure that in your, you know, eligible provider definition inside your policy and procedures that you're taking that into account is definitely important.
Well, and to add, Matt, right, we've got some states that have pharmacy practitioner rules. So that means we actually have clinician pharmacists. It's typically needed a little extra things they have to do within their state for their license to become pharmacist practitioners. And those states are going to allow for that a lot easier. But for a pharmacist to truly write in other states that don't have pharmacist practitioner rules, typically you're talking about a collaborative practice agreement that's very narrow in scope, but that's already delineated by each provider that's signed up for that service. So different ways you have to attack it. You kind of have to know what your state requires and what you're allowed to do within your state.
Talk about operational burden. So, you know, back of the envelope, Matt, what do covered entities or pharmacy departments or hospitals or clinics or whomever's pursuing this, what do they need to think about in terms of resource needs, whether it's FTEs or necessary clinical expertise to draft out these pharmacotherapy pathways? What do covered entities really need to be thinking about in terms of funding this?
That's probably going to sound odd, but the number one hurdle that I seem to have with folks is a lot of times space. Finding the appropriate space to house this type of operation, again, because we're worried about where it's located. Is it inside an eligible location? Is it inside the four walls of the hospital? And so we actually spend a good bit of time in most of our projects, you know, trying to figure out what's the right location for this to be. And then, you know, there are some synergies if you can be close by your pharmacy that can fill the prescription, right? And maybe that increases your prescription capture rate. So that's an operational burden, is understanding kind of where you're physically going to be located. I've not been into any health system and there's just been this overwhelming amount of free space. You know, most people are clamoring for space, particularly clinical space is really hard to come by. So that's one that definitely needs to be considered pretty early on, is where you're going to physically locate this. FTEs certainly needs to be considered. PTC is not as FTE intensive as you may think. So part of your analysis that we would encourage you to do is to understand exactly how many patients you have as a potential, you know, what's the average number of patients per month or per day that could be potentially seen, and then kind of back into an FTE calculation. It's very feasible to, you know, start a PTC up with one pharmacist resource. Obviously, you may want some coverage for holidays or vacation, et cetera. And then a lot of times we see folks also using combined resources. So maybe we locate the PTC common to another clinic, and that means we're able to use like the registration staff for that other clinic, and they're going to do registration for the PTC clinic as well, so that we're not adding additional FTEs there. So fairly low FTE requirement, but definitely something to consider. You mentioned clinical expertise. Yes, you want to make sure that the product that you're providing or the service that you're providing in this case is going to be of high quality. And so making sure that you have the correct pharmacist in that role that has the clinical background that they're really going to be able to bring benefit to the patient is important, right? And so making sure that you've got someone that's potentially got clinical training, or maybe they pursued some type of board certification and have done some MKR work is ideal for this type of role, just to make sure, again, that we're providing the utmost care to our patients.
If there's one thing I can share when you're looking at space, don't make the same mistake I did as a pharmacy director. I was trying to find space in our lobby, and I noticed that we had this gift shop, and I was thinking, well, maybe we can move the gift shop. So I try to take that. And if you guys know anything in our organization, we call them the pink ladies. I can tell you right now, you don't mess with the pink ladies. They're all volunteer, they're retired, and they carry some weight. So I got beat up pretty good for that one. So do not try and take over your volunteer auxiliary pink ladies staff locations. You'll get in trouble really quick.
Yeah, the gift shop is like prime real estate, and you're like, oh man, that would just be perfect. But yeah, I would advise against going down that path as well.
Yeah, that's like taking on the mafia. Don't do it.
I grew up working in a Catholic hospital here in Pittsburgh, Mercy Hospital, and it was the nuns that ran the gift shop. So I don't think anybody ever considered taking gift shop territory away from them. So Sisters of Mercy had that place locked down.
It would end poorly for you. Yes.
I guess the space needs really become your options are very flexible if you're going to adopt more of a virtual based practice. We've seen, you know, telehealth has sustained HRSA's recognition as a standard of care delivery. I think that was a big concern last year when FAQ 4301 went away. Everybody was worried that HRSA would also say, hey, look, you know, patients need to be seen in person with eligible providers, but telehealth is standard of care now. So I guess that gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of where your shop is located. It may not need to be in a thoroughfare where patients have easy access. Would you guys agree?
Well, yes and no. And I say yes and no because if you are going for kind of that standalone department that's going to be separately registered on the MCR with OPIS, you need to have charges. And those charges typically are generated from in-person encounters, which is what we typically see. A lot of times the virtual encounter is not being billed for. And so you do want to make sure you still have the ability to have some in person, and there's going to be some patients that just need in person. Yeah. You know, I think about my grandparents. You know, they wouldn't be able to do a virtual encounter with a pharmacist. You know, they're going to want to physically go there. And there's going to be those patients where you really want them to come in, right? Because you're going to help them maybe organize their pill box. You know, it may not be part of the collaborative practice agreement, but you know that medication adherence is really, you know, a key thing for this patient. And so you're going to go above and beyond and help organize their meds to kind of get them going. You can't do that virtually. You know, it's you really need to be sitting across the table from someone. So while definitely a large portion of this can be done virtually, we still like to say you got to have that physical presence. And because of that, you want something that's going to be relatively easy to get to from a patient standpoint.
Great point. Let's talk a little bit about how SpendMend works with folks in this regard. What's the type of support that we can provide to an organization out there that is really interested in doing this, think they will see a lot of value from doing this, but just doesn't know where to start?
Yeah, so we offer a full spectrum of services. And so this can go as simple as we'd like some consultation regarding the setup of a PTC. Maybe it's just the initial assessment that we talked about, right? That due diligence portion where you want to have someone run some numbers to show you what the projections would look like and what may be your optimal your optimal disease states or optimal drugs to target. Beyond that, then it becomes kind of design of the program, like how do you build it? What are the pieces that need to be in place, and consulting with making, kind of how you would structure it. And then the latter version of this is the full blown implementation where we come alongside you from day one, build our project plan. We're part of your team, weekly meetings, kind of driving the project forward and seeing it all the way to go live, and then continuing with you afterwards to monitor the success of the program. And, making sure that we've got things down like marketing, or we got the right messaging to our physicians. Do we have signage and all those things? We can help kind of make sure those are taken care of. So really anything in between we can do, we can, draft any type of custom scope that you like. But I would say right now, a lot of folks are coming to us for kind of a two-phased approach where we do the initial assessment and then they take that and try to get approval inside their organization to move forward. And then if they get approval, financial approval or executive approval to move forward, then they come back to us to help implement.
Awesome. Rob, I got a question for you. Maybe this is we can end on this. I always like to end with kind of Rob prognosticating his, thoughts of the future of 340B. With the Sustain 340B Act and all the feedback that we provided and other organizations provided back to the Senate group on potential 340B program reform, do you think pharmacotherapy service is going to be a sustained opportunity, or are there any threats based on what was drafted in the Sustain 340B Act that might make this go away?
It's a great question. And for everyone out there, Greg didn't prep me for this one, so he likes to do this to me.
Remember we talked about the Sustain 340B Act referenced the patient definition proposal from the 2015 mega regs. Do you recall from your read of the mega regs back in 2015 any threats that would have been brought up that would interfere with these types of services?
Well, so no, right? I mean, definitely for expanded patient definition and what Genesis law case one, I think there's definite threats there, right? If they decide to go back more to the mega reg. The mega reg did talk about the orders, and this is even for like infusion center, which really scared me as a pharmacy director at the time with an infusion center, an oncology infusion center, that the orders had to be written from a qualified location. If anything, to be honest, I think a PTC clinic actually has a bigger need if something goes back to something that's stringent where orders have to come from a qualified location, because the PTC clinic is a qualified location and clinical care is being provided and you're maintaining a medical record. Like the case that these orders or prescriptions qualify, I think is stronger when you have a PTC clinic versus trying to do something like an expanded patient definition for these drugs externally or even in the infusion center. Because then the PTC could also say, okay, there's some high cost drug patients. We can't really afford to do these infusions outside us, can we add that level of service with a PTC service and actually support that? Now, hopefully that doesn't go true for administer drug locations, and we're just really talking that specialty and retail prescription side.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't remember reading anything that would be a significant risk for the PTC service. I actually think the PTC service would be a sort of a defensive play in the event there is something more stringent that comes along as part of the Sustain 340B Act.
See, you can handle some unscripted questions. I think you're right. Look at how we responded. I think we were a little bit with the Sustain 340B Act and kind of them harking back to this potential patient definition from 2015. I mean, we're concerned about infusion drugs, concerned about discharge medications, concerned about referral capture not falling into what would be perceived as 340B eligible care. But there was no hint that, if you've got a pharmacist that's operating some type of clinical service out of an outpatient reimbursable department, there's no reason to believe from what was drafted in the Sustain 340B Act that this would not be a service that could be sustained and remain as a viable option for a good organization that's doing it already. So,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So no fear in pursuing this now, thinking that maybe this is a short-term gap or plug in a gap for your 340B program. There's dividends that could be paid from this type of service for a long time to come.
I personally think so. And again, I think it's that changing healthcare landscape where pharmacists are more and more starting to be seen as practitioners. They have this clinical knowledge that can really benefit patient care, right? We're not just behind the counter counting pills by five or twos and threes, which we've talked about.
Yeah, somebody who counts by threes again? Somebody counts by threes. It doesn't make any sense to me, but
they're different. Yeah. Different people. But I think that's so important because, I mean, right, everyone now who graduates and even our seasoned practitioners who've been around before that change, they're all doctors of pharmacy. They spend extra time on the clinical side and do a lot more rotations in clinical areas. There's this level of expertise that's there within our pharmacists professionals that I think is underutilized. I think this is a great way to start utilizing that to improve patient care. And I would love it if you have residency programs or students that you can even start measuring the impact of some of these services, present them as posters, writing them up, you know, in ASHP or, you know, other journals, really showing this care. And there's already some of that going on, but I think even increasing that body of knowledge, showing actual clinically statistically relevant outcomes, sorry, that was a lot, regarding a service like this would be huge. Cause I personally believe and no one has seen that there's benefit to patients when pharmacists intervene, especially in these high costs, really complex medical conditions.
Yeah, I mean, Matt led off with it. And I totally agree. The primary benefit of doing this is really to improve health outcomes in your communities. And there just happens to be this secondary benefit of 340B program eligibility that can only help you further this mission. So, you know, I definitely agree that, you know, if you're going to do this, definitely think about how you want to measure success and would encourage folks to really, you know, try to publicize the improvements that they're able to measure from pharmacist-based services like this.
Yeah.
All right. Either you guys have any last thoughts before we end for the day?
No, I'm good.
Great discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, Matt, thanks again for hopping on. I'm sure we'll have you on again in the future.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Just to remind you all, we've got a webinar coming up. It's a pharmacist and technician CE offering May 14th, 2 p.m. Eastern. We'll have a link to register in the show notes. Heidi from our group, Megan, both have been on the podcast in the past. They've both done webinars before. They're going to be talking about self-auditing strategies for covered entities and making sure that you're providing great internal oversight of your 340B program. So don't miss that. Rob, Matt, it's good catching up with you guys. Everyone,
I got to say one thing though. We already said happy birthday to you, but for Megan, because if you listen to Megan's episode, I feel like I got called out a little bit. So I just want to say Megan, who is an amazing pharmacist auditor out of Philadelphia, I've worked with her for many, many years. Really appreciate all she does, especially on her grantee side. And again, not saying anything about Heidi or anybody or Sabrina or anybody else that was on, but I just want to specifically highlight Megan for the amazing job that she does and how she takes care of her clients and really has a passion for 340B and improving what we do.
Great plug. Everybody tune in to listen to Megan talk about self-auditing May 14th. All right, guys, thanks again for joining. Everyone, thanks for listening. If you have any questions for us, comments, or topics you want us to address, email us at 340bunscripted@spendmen.com. We'll catch you the next time. Take care.
Thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.